from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, fewer than 40% of Americans approve of President Obama's performance in office. That's based on an average of 8 prominent polls. And it's Obama's lowest approval rating so far and comes amid continuing problems with the Affordable Care Act. If the experience of other second-term presidents is any guide, it will be very hard for him to bounce back. What does the president's falling popularity bode for his effectiveness in the remainder of his term, and how much are President Obama's current problems likely to tarnish his legacy? Forum is next. Join us for the hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. A number of polls reveal that President Obama's approval and trust ratings are both at all-time lows, hovering under 40%. And the drops are reflected in a number of wide-ranging demographic groups, including women, Hispanics, millennials, and independents. This morning's opening Forum hour, we evaluate what these dropping numbers mean, as well as what they bode for the Obama presidency and for the nation. We want to go first to Princeton and welcome Julian Zelizer, who is Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University. And Professor Zelizer, good to have you with us on Forum. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
I guess a good place to begin is maybe to get some analysis from you. I want to get the historical perspective as well about second-term presidents, but some are saying this is really less to do with the economy than it has to do with the rollout of affordable health care and NSA and IRS and maybe throw in Syria and Iran. In other words, multifactorial.
Well, second-term presidencies are always difficult. That is a fact. Even though we think after that second reelection, a president will have a lot of power to move legislation, often their opponents are more energized to go after them. So part of what's happening is a traditional problem that presidents encounter. FDR encountered this after his landslide victory in 1936. Southern Democrats and Republicans were more defiant and caused him more problems in his second term. Part of it is particular. It's obviously the health care rollout did not go well. It lent material to his opponents to attack him, and some of these other problems have amplified the dilemmas that he's faced with public trust. So I think it's a combination of predictable second-term trouble with very specific failures or problems that he's encountered. And then you have to add to that the very polarized atmosphere where the attacks have just been incessant regardless of what he does.
Well, I know you've written about the fact that short-term struggles tend to not matter much, especially when the policies become entrenched. In the Bush administration, for example, counterterrorism went on into the next administration, or you mentioned FDR, and that's also, it seems to me, a very good example. Social Security started pretty shaky under FDR, but it became entrenched. Is it possible or likely, as some Obama advisors have said, that if he gets past this big hurdle on affordable health care, that it won't matter that much for the rest of this administration?
Absolutely. I think we do have to separate the discussion of the polls that we see day to day versus the long term and how his programs will do. I think it's not inevitable that the program will do well, nor is it inevitable all parts of it will survive. There are examples of Social Security where programs start on shaky ground and then thrive. There's other examples like the Medicare catastrophic program in the late 1980s that do poorly. But I think if the program can survive the next few years, and then the following administration accepts the program and it remains in place and grows and the benefits become something people expect, it's very likely that decades from now this will be seen as a controversial yet very important accomplishment of the administration. So there are just many examples where these kinds of controversies are part of the first few years of a bill.
Julian Zelizer, again, is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. I know, for example, that you've also written about Reagan's negotiations over intermediate-range missiles with the Soviets, at first causing a great deal of consternation, even among many conservatives who distrusted Gorbachev. But that became, in many people's judgment, the crowning achievement of his administration. And now we have the president yesterday giving what has been characterized as his legacy building speech, or at least an attempt at one, on doing something in the next few years on economic inequality.
Yeah, the Reagan example is relevant, obviously, for the discussions with Iran. If you go back and read the record of the time, it is amazing in 1985 and 1986 when Gorbachev emerges and Reagan decides to have these negotiations, just how controversial that was. Many people in both parties, but certainly many conservatives, didn't trust Gorbachev. They thought this was a big ploy. Many, including the columnist George Will, were openly attacking the president for doing what he had told Republicans never to do, negotiate with the Soviet Union. And there he was doing that. But now we look back, and most historians, most American citizens and journalists say this really was one of the best moments for this presidency, and it helped lead to an end of the Cold War. With the inequality speech, we will see. I mean, this is clearly one of the big issues of our time, and I don't think there will be tons of disagreement, certainly among Democrats, that what President Obama said is true. The question is, what will he do about it? I mean, he has pointed to measures that haven't gotten through because of the opposition. But in the end, if it's a speech in a period that is defined by growing inequality without the government able to do much about it, this speech won't go down as anything that is as defining as the health care program. The only alternative is if the speech motivates Democrats to really try to do more and to make this a core issue in 2016.
We are going to hear in the course of this hour from Charles Krauthammer, who has called the Iran deal the worst deal since Munich, 1938 appeasement, and called it a farce. But I guess from your perspective, you're saying we're going to have to see what occurs as far as nuclear power with Iran before making that kind of judgment?
Yeah, domestic policy, foreign policy is hard to evaluate right away. And I think on foreign policy, maybe even more, it's just hard to read what happens and what other events will shape how we look back at this moment. So we're going to have to see, A, if an agreement, a permanent agreement, emerges, and then what kind of dangers or what kinds of security and then peace result from this in the coming decades. And foreign policy is just extraordinarily difficult to gauge on that front. Similarly with there's a few examples like Vietnam where it looks bad when it happens and it continues to look bad thereafter, but there's many more where we just need time to watch this and to sort through the kind of rhetorical arguments versus the reality.
And what about on the domestic side? I mean, there's certainly been, according to polls, a lot of concern over the failure to rein in domestic spending. How much does that play into this evaluation and ongoing evaluation of this Obama presidency?
That's, I think, the most difficult in that you can look at almost any presidency, Republican or Democrat, and this is always part of the politics, the attacks on deficit spending, certainly since the 1930s and then since the 1950s, is just a perennial issue. Every president is accused of spending too much. Reagan was accused of spending too much. And the concern over the deficit is a great political issue. It certainly works on the campaign trail and has helped at least re-energize Republicans. But over the long term, it's just hard to see that's the main measure that people take of presidents. Spending has gone up, government has grown, and both parties have been part of that process in the 20th and 21st century. So I'm not sure the deficit is really going to be the main issue that we think of with Obama, other than how it became a political tool after 2010 for tying up his administration.
Julian Zelizer, again, is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. He's with us by phone this morning. I'll get just a final, maybe a historical perspective from you, Professor Zelizer, on second-term presidents. It's hard and has been proven hard through the past for them to bounce back. What wisdom can you give us about the kind of most formidable obstacles that this president faces?
Well, the most formidable obstacle for him is one of implementation. I mean, every second term president has their issues. For President Clinton, it was surviving impeachment. For President Obama, it's about implementing this health care program and the financial reform measure. I think those two measures, which came out of the first term, were very complicated. They entailed many challenges that were, you know, pretty formidable in terms of implementation. And I think while Obama wants new policies like immigration reform, and I think that would be quite significant, he's putting most of his money on making sure these two programs are in place, they are up and running, and the next president and the next Congress can't really dismantle them. I don't think the challenge has to do with polls, and I think he's probably best served ignoring them. And there's limits of what kind of new bills he's going to get. But these two programs are in place, and I think there's more control in terms of making sure that they work, they function, and they last and outlast him.
And Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. Charles Krauthammer is Pulitzer Prize-winning syndicated columnist and political commentator, also an MD and contributing editor to the Weekly Standard, and author most recently of Things That Matter, Three Decades of Passions, Pastimes, and Politics, which is number one on the New York Times bestseller list. Charles Krauthammer, good to have you with us on Forum. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
I guess let's begin by something I referenced, that you had said that Iran is probably the worst deal since Munich and a farce. What we're hearing from Professor Zelizer is it's too hard to gauge foreign affairs at this point. We don't know what's around the corner. And you would say what?
Well, we never know what's around the corner. That's why we have diplomacy, and that's why we make agreements based on what we think is coming.
Well, forgive me. Let me qualify that a bit more. I think what Professor Zelizer was suggesting was we don't know yet whether it will lead to something very positive as far as nuclear disarmament with Iran or something along those lines.
There is no chance it's going to lead to nuclear disarmament by Iran, because the essence of the deal, which is what the Iranians had been lusting for a decade, was to get the de facto approval of the West and, of course, the United States for its, quote, right to enrich. Now, the right to enrich uranium is a total contradiction of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The whole point of the last five Security Council resolutions, which, incidentally, the Chinese and the Russians, who weren't exactly hard line on this, had signed on to and insisted on, was that Iran has to stop enrichment. And unless it stops all enrichment of uranium, there would be no relief of sanctions. What this agreement does is to completely overturn that, which is exactly what Iran had sought. Once Iran has the right to enrich uranium, once it has that ability and it has the stockpiles, that will perpetually leave it just a month or two away from a breakout, which would allow it to go nuclear. Everybody understands that, which is precisely why Iran had been seeking this. It means that it can stay in a state in which it is within the breakout range without actually having gone nuclear, which leaves it unmolested and yet an essential nuclear power. That's why the Gulf Arabs have their hair on fire. They understood that we gave away the store in this agreement. And worse than that, this is only an interim agreement, so that we're doing this relaxing the sanctions, and somehow we expect that we're going to get a final agreement in 6 months after having relaxed the sanctions, a final agreement which will be a lot harder in Iran than this. If you can't get a real stoppage to the Iranian program when we have maximum pressure of sanctions, how in God's name are we going to get the true suspension of the program and the rollback of the program after the sanctions have begun to be relieved?
I certainly understand your position. However, I would add the simple fact that probably the lack of trust in the Obama presidency may have a lot less to do with Iran than it has to do with the Affordable Care Act or domestic policies. And I want to get you on record, at least in terms of that lack of trust. I mean, you've said some things about, the rhetoric of Obama. The lack of trust is perhaps the American public is seeing beyond that rhetoric as you see it?
Look, what I just said about Iran and this agreement has nothing to do with lack of trust in this administration. I didn't even use the word trust. It's a matter of judgment. It's a matter of what's in the agreement. It's a matter of what the United States as a country has acceded to in a written, signed interim agreement with Iran. It has nothing to do with trust.
Well, no, I'm raising the context here because we've been talking about the
falling... You were trying to do a segue, in other words.
Well, no, the falling polls that President Obama is faced with was what we talked with Professor Zelizer about, and the lack of trust in President Obama. I'm just saying that from your perspective, certainly the Iran accord or agreement or whatever you want to call it is what you would characterize as a disaster. But I think people's lower opinion of this administration probably has more to do with the Affordable Care rollout and with domestic policies.
Well, that's true, and I'm not claiming that this has an effect on public opinion. Public opinion in the U.S. is rarely swayed one way or the other by what happens abroad unless there's something spectacular like a war. But you're absolutely right. The president standing right now is a function of the disaster of the Affordable Care Act rather than anything he's been doing with Iran. In fact, if anything, I suspect an announcement of some kind of accord, however vague it is in the way it's reported, probably helps the president because it always looks good to be doing diplomacy. But his problem now is that the centerpiece of his administration, the centerpiece of his legacy, is this Affordable Care Act. And unfortunately for the president, it hasn't gone very well.
Well, yesterday, the president, and by the way, we are talking about the president's legacy and the falling polls. Yesterday, he said, in effect, my legacy now and for the rest of this administration will be, I think it was a legacy-building speech, economic inequality. That's the most important issue. That's going to be his yardstick.
Well, maybe he'd like to think that. And that's what I would say if I spent 5 years investing in a program that is now looks like a disaster, and I had only 3 years left of my presidency, I would want to change the subject as well. So I can't say I blame him, but I'm not sure it's a credible claim.
And from your perspective, it's almost, or maybe not even almost, I believe you think it's hopeless that immigration reform will come in this administration?
I'm not sure it's hopeless. I think the bill coming out of the Senate will not succeed, the comprehensive bill. I think even the administration itself has begun to consider whether it will go for a step-by-step approach, which probably will be proposed. If anything comes out of the House, it would be that. And so I don't think nothing necessarily will happen, but I do think the comprehensive deal, the one where everything is done in one gigantic effort, has no chance of passage.
I also wonder if you're in agreement with Rush Limbaugh, who has gone on record as saying that perhaps the lack of trust in President Obama or the reason his numbers have fallen in terms of support of Americans has to do with the fact that people feel, be tender about how I paraphrase what Rush Limbaugh had to say, but that people don't feel as sensitive to criticizing Obama and being branded as racist.
Well, that's a kind of a meta-psychology that I, as a licensed psychiatrist, would like to stay away from. It's hard enough to analyze a patient on the couch with whom you have a relationship and analyze the psyche of the nation. I think the reason that people are lacking trust in the president and saying so openly is because he committed a whopper. He said, if you like your plans, you will have your plan. And then he made the fatal error. He was the first death by punctuation in American political history, where he added the word, period. When you say, if you like the plan, you can have your plan, period, what you've said is no caveats, no excuses, no explanations, no wiggle room, no curlicues around this declaration. You heard it, and this is what I'm promising you. Turn out to be not only untrue, but spectacularly untrue. And spectacularly untrue for the 5 million Americans who received notices that their plans were canceled, and for the tens of millions of Americans who are going to receive the same notice next year when their employers drop them. So it was a falsehood, and it is hard to believe the president wasn't aware of it at the time. There's some empirical evidence that he knew that Americans, many Americans, would lose their plans. In fact, it's necessary for the economics of Obamacare to work, for millions of Americans to be kicked off their individual plans, sent into these exchanges, overpay in their premiums because they are younger and healthier, and have that surplus be used to subsidize others in the exchanges. There's no other way to make the exchanges.
It's vital for him to get the millennials. And I should mention that just yesterday, a Harvard survey was released that said young people between the ages of 18 and 29 are unhappy with this presidency as well. And it prompts me, and again, Charles Krauthammer with us from the nation's capital, is Pulitzer Prize winning syndicated columnist, author most recently of Things That Matter, Three Decades of Passions, Pastimes, and Politics, number one bestseller on the New York Times. And Chris Lehane is a Democratic consultant, partner in Fabiani and Lehane. He's a former aide to the Clinton White House and spent 6 years in the Clinton White House, was Al Gore's press secretary throughout the 2000 campaign. And Chris Lehane, good to have you with us here on Forum this morning. Good morning.
Michael, thanks for having me back. I was intrigued by hearing you quoting Rush Limbaugh, which may have been a first.
It probably is a first. But some see him as the titular head of the Republican Party. What can President Obama do to bounce back, Chris Lehane?
Well, you know, first of all, I was someone who was in the Clinton White House, and the professor, you know, talked about this earlier, you know, where really there was an enterprise challenge to his presidency in the form of the impeachment process. And obviously, based on the information that came out, impacted his poll standings. And, you know, it's important to remember that by the time he left office with the highest job approval ratings of any president in history. And so while I certainly agree, particularly with what the professor said about the challenges of a second-term presidency, I think compounded, you know, by the political paralysis that exists and the institutional challenges that exist, I do think it's important to recognize that you have had presidents who have been able to come back from adversity in the second term and succeed. And I actually think that this president will be able to do that. You know, one of the issues that we haven't really talked about in this conversation thus far is really the role of the economy in all of this. I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, it is the single most dispositive factor in terms of what a president's political standing is at any moment in time. And obviously, you know, we are seeing some improvements in the economy. I think everyone agrees it's not enough and there needs to be more. But if the growth rate goes at the rate that people are predicting 6 months, 8 months, a year from now, what has been, for the most part, throughout his presidency, headwinds suddenly become tailwinds.
Well, that's the anthem of, again, the Clinton administration's the economy, stupid. But
right.
A lot of these polls reveal that the economy is not paramount in the people's minds who are responding.
No question that's what the polls show, but it is the context in which the polls are taking place, right? If people are feeling better about the economy, they feel better about the direction of the country, they have a more favorable view of the job that the president is doing. That's just the reality, and that's always been the principle in terms of how polls work and how presidential standings and how that relates to a president's standing. And I'd also, you know, posit that, you know, there's two different conversations here, right? There is one where he stands at this moment in time in a particular era where there's enormous volatility in polling. And, you know, you can go 6 or 8 weeks and suddenly see, you know, pretty significant swings in where standing is just because of how people consume information and then how that's reflected in a poll, which is a, you know, a snapshot of a moment in time. But the other issue is where are you standing from a historical perspective? And I do believe that when you start to take a big step back and you look at this president, there's going to be some very significant accomplishments from a historical perspective. First of all, he comes in with the economy on the abyss, and in large part due to his policies, stops the economy from falling even further. He's responsible for getting bin Laden, which any number of previous presidents had tried and not succeeded. He did get us out of the war in Iraq. He did save Detroit. And I do think, and the professor made this point, and I would concur, that while, you know, that we don't know for sure if the healthcare program does end up working out and there are green shoots that suggest it's going in the right direction, president's clearly on the right side of history on that, the same way that FDR was on Social Security.
Well, his approval numbers may be around 38% or so, but Congress is at 9%. We have to put that into perspective as well in this discussion. And by the way, you can join this discussion. Obama's hitting the lowest ever approval ratings, and your thoughts about that, lack of trust and lack of approval, and what it means in the long run for the second-term presidency. Our toll-free number is available to you, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. It's 866-733-6786. Again, feel free to join us. Toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQEDForum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the fact that fewer than 40% of Americans approve of President Obama's performance in office. That's based on an average of 8 prominent polls. And it's his lowest approval rating so far and comes amid continuing problems with the Affordable Health Care Act. If the experience of other second-term presidents is any guide, it will be very hard for him to bounce back. And what does the president's falling popularity bode for his effectiveness in the remainder of his term, and how much are his current problems likely to tarnish his legacy? How do you feel about the Obama presidency at this point, and do you approve of the job, or do you think you can trust the president? You know, there has been certainly a lot brought up about NSA and the IRS scandals, about Syria and Iran, and about the rollout of the Affordable Health Care Act. But as we just heard from Chris Lehane before the break, it seems as if the economy is moving back and moving forward when it was on the brink. And the president did get bin Laden, and he did actually achieve affordable health care, although, as Charles Krauthammer pointed out, promised that you could keep your insurance policy, maybe also a hospital and doctor, and that proved not to be the case after the period that Charles Krauthammer alluded to. Charles Krauthammer is with us, by the way, from Washington, Pulitzer Prize-winning syndicated columnist and author of Things That Matter, Three Decades of Passions, Pastimes, and Politics, and Chris Lehane, Democratic consultant and partner in Fabiani and Lehane, and former aide to the Clinton White House and Al Gore's press secretary during the vice presidency. And Julian Zelizer, who is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. We have a panel. We also have an opportunity for you to join us with any questions or comments you might have. Our toll-free number, again, is 866-733-6786. There are a number of other ways you can communicate with us, your thoughts or your feelings. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. Or you can post questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or you can go to our Facebook page. Just read a couple of emails here quickly. This is a young listener who says, I'm a Gen X-er, a progressive, and I was a big Obama supporter. Far more than any other factor that has caused my enthusiasm for the president to wane is the Snowden revelations. As much as I like Obama, I feel I just can't trust him. And another listener, Nisi, writes, if racism would step aside, his ratings would be fine, but this country is still to this day obsessed with race, especially with black Americans succeeding. And Beth writes, and I referenced this before we went to the break, about how low the approval ratings are for the United States Congress. She says, have you seen the polls lately that say Congress has even lower poll ratings? What does that say? It grieves me that President Obama promised an open, honest look at all he was going to do. Yet so many promises have been broken. Gitmo is still operating. We're still in a war. The ACA system is a mess. No immigration reform. Still higher unemployment numbers than expected. And he doesn't seem comfortable dealing with we the people unless it's in some type of organized pseudo-campaign event. Let me go to your calls and let's find out what's on your minds. And we begin with Charles. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Michael. I supported Obama through both elections. And I recall during his campaign, one of the words I heard him use was transparency. And the NSA revelations and the way the Attorney General has been going after the press really bother me. And, you know, as a nation. And in light of Edward Snowden's revelations, I want to say I believe Mr. Snowden is a patriot and a whistleblower, and I'd like to see something done about that, because this is clearly a black mark on his treatment of the Constitution.
Charles, I thank you for that call, and let me actually go to Charles Krauthammer, who is, I suppose, on the right here this morning. You know, President Obama has been labeled a lot as a socialist and all sorts of things that suggest that he's too much of a progressive by the right. But the fact is, he did promise transparency, and a lot of people on the left, like that first caller, are quite alienated because of the lack of transparency in the Snowden revelations.
Well, I think there's been a lack of transparency in a lot of the things he's done, which has alienated left and right. I mean, in the way, for example, the caller mentioned, the way they went after the Associated Press and the way they went after one particular reporter on Fox News, where it seemed to be just skirting illegality. But certainly it was very much non-transparent. When you talk about some of the other things the administration has done, I think the fact that it has not in any way been as open and has been promised has left a lot of people disappointed. And on the NSA, the problem to me is this sort of gross contradiction. You know, he gave a very important speech about 6 months ago about the war on terror, saying this must end. It's changing our country in a way that we don't like. It's putting us on a war footing. We can't forever be like this. I think there are many Americans who agree with him. And yet at the same time, it turned out from the Snowden revelations, he's running, or he at least is aware of, or his own government is running this incredible surveillance program. So how do you explain, on the one hand, a man saying to these people, the war has to end, we've exaggerated the threat, it's changing us, and at the same time, he's running a vast intelligence program whose only raison d'etre is to fight the war on terror, that on the other hand, he's denigrating or saying ought to be ended or is exaggerated. So I think there's a real contradiction at the heart of that that has left people on the left and the right quite dismayed.
Can I get you to opine on this, Chris Lehane? Because you have to factor this in as part of the erosion of trust in Obama as a big factor.
Sure. I mean, look, I come at this, you know, with I guess a couple of different views. I mean, first of all, I think, you know, a large number of Americans are rightly concerned about the domestic surveillance issues and what's been, you know, exposed and communicated.
Well, and forgive me, a lot of foreign governments are also concerned.
Well, I was going to bifurcate those two things, or distinguish between those two things, because, you know, I mean, you know, Mr. Krauthammer had spent a great deal of time earlier in the call talking about what a grave mistake trying to pursue a program in Iran is. Right? Obviously, this is an administration that is taking every single effort to try to protect the long-term security of our country. And having been someone who's been at the White House and knowing what it's like to see a president or a vice president or a senior aides get what is called the presidential security briefing, which is a briefing that you get from your intelligence agencies every morning that lists countless challenges to the country. And you as commander-in-chief are responsible for trying to make the right decisions to protect the country based on information that, you know, you really are, you and you alone, or you and a very small subset of folks are privy to, you know, is an incredibly challenging and difficult job. And I do believe that this is a president who has demonstrated time and time and time again that he does take his responsibility as commander-in-chief and the responsibility to protect our country and our people's security very, very seriously. So when I look at that program, I do distinguish, at least in my view, between what's going on in terms of trying to protect the U.S. and get information at an international level from what's going on domestically. Now, clearly, the administration has not done a particularly good job of communicating this. They've continued to be behind the ball in terms of information coming out and not getting in front of it and actually trying to explain what is happening and what isn't happening. I mean, again, as someone who's been in Washington, served in administrations, you know, the idea that we are getting intelligence on foreign entities is not something that's particularly new or revelatory. But yet, you know, in the context of this conversation, it's been covered as if it's something that's brand new. And so, you know, I do have some empathy for the position they're in, but I also believe that they should have done a much, much better job of actually explaining to the public and having that conversation with the public. People get this stuff if you actually have that conversation with them.
Professor Zelzer, Julian Zelzer, can I get you on record on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both predictable and understandable that there'd be a lot of frustration among liberals, among the left, but also mainstream Democrats on this issue of surveillance and other national security issues. It's understandable why this has emerged and how a president can change once in office, but this is a president who came into office in 2008 at a moment that Democrats were highly critical of what the Bush administration had done, and a president who made some very poignant comments about the need to conduct the fight against terrorism in a different way, with greater respect for civil liberties and restraints on what government agencies can do. So it's natural that when this all comes out, and doesn't come out through the administration, but through, you know, leaks and reporters revealing this stuff, that there is going to be a lot of anger. And so I do think, actually, in the long term, this will be an important part of how we think and evaluate and study his presidency, because a lot of the changes we saw after 9/11 have been institutionalized, have been expanded in certain respects under a Democrat, and it gives it a kind of bipartisan imprimatur that will make it very lasting. It's like, you know, when Dwight Eisenhower accepts Social Security and grows it, that program becomes a bipartisan program. And you could argue with national security, you've seen a similar phenomenon, and in part because of who Obama was in 2008, 2008, I think some of that anger is more visceral among liberals than it otherwise would have been, even if it had been, you know, Hillary Clinton who won. I think it might have been a different dynamic.
I'm going to bring another caller on. And Gabriel, join us. You're on Forum. Good morning.
Yes, Michael. You know, I just want to get clear a couple of things here. You know, every time you have a discussion about the president, it's very, very hard, and it's very insulting to all of the Democrats who voted for the president. This president has done everything possible. But you know what? This Congress, made up of all these Republicans, the Republicans have always been opposed to this president. They cannot accept the fact that this has been a two-term Black American president, and that's what's killing them. And they have pledged to block everything and anything that he has proposed because he's a Black American. And for you, Michael, to be on the radio and to be talking about the president negatively at every time that I listen to your radio, I'm very disgusted because you're using this medium to promote your disapproval, your dislike, and your non-support for this president. I'm truly upset with NPR at this point, Michael.
Well, I'm sorry you feel that way. I feel impugned, though, because I'm not necessarily expressing my own opinions here. But Charles Krauthammer, we only have a few moments left with you. I know you have to leave a quarter of, but there are certainly many who would argue that this president has been undermined by a Republican Congress, particularly the House of Representatives. It's been very difficult to get his agenda through. He got affordable health care through, but other things have been extraordinarily difficult. And you would say what to that argument?
I would say that in the same way that Democrats, out of a matter of principle, opposed the second term of Bush when he proposed to partially privatize Social Security and killed it in the crib. Republicans, as a matter of principle, looking at the issue in a completely different way, have honorably and well with, I wouldn't say successfully, but they have honorably tried to stop the Affordable Care Act, predicting, I think, rather accurately.
Try to stop by stopping the government?
No, that's not how they did it. They did it.
Well, certainly Ted Cruz and company did.
Come on now. I mean, they spent a year and a half in Congress debating it, arguing against it, taking votes on it, and in the end they failed. And that is how it works in this system. President proposes, the opposition opposes. I think they not only were honorable in opposing it, I think they were accurate in predicting that this attempt to revolutionize one-sixth of the American economy was way beyond the competence of government and would have the kind of unintended, actually some of them intended, consequences that would leave the American people deeply dismayed and opposed, is exactly as happening now. So I don't see it as a negative against Republicans for having opposed a bill that is demonstrably doing very badly and quite likely will collapse of its own weight and incoherence. I would say it's a positive, and history will record it that way.
Charles Krauthammer, thank you for being with us on Forum. I know you have to leave, and I appreciate your being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And again, he's Pulitzer Prize-winning syndicated columnist, political commentator, and a physician, and the author of Things That Matter, Three Decades of Passions, Pastimes, and Politics. And I have to go to you, Chris Lehane.
In response to that?
Well, you know, the Republicans acted honorably, essentially, by trying to stop affordable health care. Actually, all they had to do was wait, and things would have taken a different turn if they hadn't tried to shut down the government, or at least some of them.
Look, I'll make 2 points on that. First of all, I guess I would disagree with the idea that it was an honorable opposition. And in fact, you know, you made the precise right point, which is it's one thing to oppose something when it's going through the legislative process. It's another thing to effectively shut down our government, harm our economy, and hold the entire country, at least politically, hostage because of an effort to try to stand in the way of a law that had been passed entirely consistent with our constitutional system, and where it was impossible for them within our constitutional system to be able to overturn that law. And so to me, you know, that was dishonorable, dishonorable being defined as, you know, is this actually in the best interest of our country to try to harm our economy, close our government down? And I think that, you know, any objective analysis would say that is dishonorable. You know, the other point I would make is that, you know, even if you subscribe to the belief that people on the Republican side are acting honorably, and surely that there are some members who are doing that. I think there are some who are not. I mean, I go back to the first term where the Republican head of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, said, you know, effectively that, you know, our objective is to make this president a first-term president. Not that our objective is actually to do right by the people or help deal with this economic crisis that we're facing, but to make this president a first-term president or one-term president. So I think that gives you a little bit of an insight. That's from the Republican leader in the U.S. Senate of the mindset. But you also do have this incredible challenge with the infrastructure that now exists politically, which is even if people are acting honorably to try to take positions, you have a political system that now is broken. A lot of that comes back to the types of districts that people are from. You know, in particular, you have Republicans who are from what I call 80-20 districts, where, you know, it's much more important that they survive a primary, because if they win a primary, they're going to win their general election. And so instead of having a system designed to forge compromise, send people to the 50-yard line, get people to compromise, we now have a political system where people are effectively being incentivized to go in the opposite direction, to go towards their end zones, towards their base, and not to work towards consensus. And so when you combine both the what I view as a dishonorable component along with the paralysis infrastructure challenge, that's an incredibly challenging dynamic to be trying to be governing within.
Another caller joining us, William from Belvedere. Good morning.
Yes, thank you very much. I would very much appreciate the guest perspective on whether or not, and if so, to what extent, they feel that negative feelings about the president at this time will predict what will happen in terms of the future, in terms of left or right. And the reason that I say that is, for instance, people may say, do you like the health plan? And many people don't. But some people don't like it because they feel that it's too far a move towards the left, whereas other people feel we really need single-payer health care. So they may both feel negative about that aspect of what the president is doing, but it doesn't have anything to mean that therefore they're going to vote right or left in future elections.
I think that's a good point. And let me go to Julian Zelizer on that. I mean, what does this bode in terms of the country moving, say, even to a small extent more to the left or more to the right when we have these kind of poll numbers?
Well, you know, at some level, if they would last, if they would bleed into the 2016 election, or they would have a huge impact against Democrats, for example, on 2014 and set up even worse congressional conditions for this president, it would bode well for the GOP. It would bode well for conservatism. It would probably push Democrats more toward the center in the presidential campaign of 2016. So the feelings themselves and these perceptions can have that impact. But we are very far, certainly, from the presidential elections. And I think it just remains very important to remember how much this stuff fluctuates. And even how confusing.
Well, but forgive me, we're not that far from the congressional elections.
We are not, but we always have to remember those congressional polls. So Congress is in the tank right now. Most people identify Congress with the GOP, and ratings on the Republicans are horrendous. So Republicans might be celebrating about Obama's numbers, but they don't have much to say about their own. So I don't think the polls move us in either direction very clearly. And I think a lot of Republicans are aware of this. That's why they have backed off, at least temporarily, from the budget battles that kept bringing their numbers down.
I keep thinking, I mean, about the historical perspective that you've provided in some of your writings, where you mentioned Harry Truman as one of the most unpopular presidents during his time. Now, just the opposite.
Well, that's true. I mean, whenever people talk about presidential legacies as the presidency is in process, we have to remember those predictions are just impossible. The reputation of presidents can change dramatically over time. Harry Truman was immensely unpopular and now is consistently in these top 10 lists people put out. It's also to remember there is no such thing as a presidential legacy. They change, they evolve. You know, people interpret presidents within the context of the period in which they are living. And we see a revitalization of certain presidents unexpectedly. This is what happened to Dwight Eisenhower, who ended very popular, then over time wasn't seen as one of the great presidents, but has reemerged as a hero of sorts. So all of this stuff is just very dynamic, and we shouldn't read too much into where a president is at the end of their term. And I'd just add, in this day and age, as we see with Bill Clinton or Jimmy Carter, presidents have the ability to really help shape the legacy after they're gone, and influence how people think of them based on what they do once the term is long over.
Let me thank the caller and remind you that you just heard the voice of Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton, and I want to bring some more voices in this that are coming to us via email. Dan writes, think the discussion misses a key point. One can give low approval rating to the president because of ACA or NSA, but would never vote for the other side. Can always hope that the president does vastly better, but it's always compared to what? And Eugene writes, it's truly a shame that the media pointedly avoids the racist aspect of Obama's governance issues, though this aspect is merely another hurdle he must transcend. It is a major factor in his ability to function. Had he ever had a complete staff? Unfortunately, in my opinion, his administration, which he is ultimately responsible for, totally botched the rollout of Obamacare, and they had to know that a smoother rollout was an absolute necessity. Another emailer, Sandy, writes, there's more to this, these poor ratings than just the problems with the ACA. Look at the entire presidency. Could you have your guest comment on these reasons, use of drones in other countries? I think this violates international law and constitutional law, or rather than being the progressive president he branded himself to be, we are the change we've been waiting for. He's become the corporate president, reflected in his appointments of corporate executives to cabinet offices and to head agencies. Again, it's kind of coming from the left, Julian Zelizer, but it's certainly eroded the support that President Obama had and caused some disillusionment?
Sure. On the race part that someone mentioned, race is clearly an element with some Americans, and it's, I think, incorrect to just ignore that that's there. I don't think race is the driving force behind all the partisan animosity we've seen. Certainly you can go back to the 1990s and see the same kind of toxic feelings toward President Clinton. And the second part, though, it's true. And context matters in a presidency, and this president has faced a very difficult political context, but he's made mistakes as well, and he's taken some controversial positions he's had to live with. The ACA rollout, by any account, was a mistake. It was poorly handled, and he, knowing his opponents were lined up against him, he just gave them the exact kind of material they wanted, such as the website, and we've now learned it wasn't ready. It wasn't really ready to go when the time came. And he's made controversial decisions he'll live by. The drone strikes, the surveillance, even some of the relationships with the world of finance, where he went against part of what he campaigned on. And so I think those criticisms are legitimate, and they will remain a part of the discussion about what he did.
Let me bring in a few more comments as part of the discussion. Another listener writes on our website, it seems like the polls don't discriminate between those who are unhappy with President Obama because he isn't liberal enough versus those who are unhappy with him because he isn't conservative enough. But this distinction must be taken into account when extrapolating to the 2014 election and beyond. And Mike writes, everyone hates the current sitting president. They are not our mothers whose job it is to make us feel good. They must govern the country and steer the country for the good of all citizens and not just the powerful or the most noisy. And Aaron writes, how much of Obama's poll numbers are just a reflection of Americans' disgust with the inability of the current Congress and federal government to move forward with anything new in terms of policy? Let me bring a young listener on. Misha, join us. Welcome.
Hi. Yeah. As a 21-year-old, I wanted to speak to the Harvard poll that just came out recently about young people and their perception of Obama and the federal government in general. I was too young to vote in the first election, and as a way that kind of helps me feel less guilt and less shame as to electing this president and all the broken promises he hasn't kept. In the second election, I kind of had a different perspective of looking more objectively and deciding whether or not to vote for him. And I think these young people in America are kind of being more skeptical about Obama and also about the Republican Party and trying to find a new route and not looking to either party to solve their problems.
Well, I thank you for those comments, Misha. It's good to hear from you. And as I said, that Harvard study just came out yesterday that says that young people are also unhappy with this presidency. Chris Lehane, what do you make of the fact that these approval ratings and trust ratings are really just a couple of points below what Richard Nixon found himself with in his second term with Watergate facing him?
Well, look, I think there's a couple of things. You know, first of all, you know, anytime you're a sitting president, every day you're making 100, if not 1,000 decisions, and those decisions are now out there in a public way, different really than any other time in our nation's history. And so every time you make a decision, there's going to be some people who are happy and some people who are unhappy, and that has a cumulative impact, which takes me to a second point, which I think has always been a challenge for President Obama. And, you know, in my view, he does a very good job of making day in and day out decisions, but doesn't necessarily get the full credit that he deserves, because he really has, you know, over the course of his 5+ years, not really given an overarching vision or theory of the case or organizing principle to where he is taking the country. And I think that then, you know, exposes him or leaves him vulnerable to every time he makes a decision to some subset of folks being unhappy and not necessarily seeing how this ties in to a bigger idea of where he is going. And I think that that has impacted his ability to be, or at least to be perceived as effective as I think he actually, in fact, has been. The final point I will make, and, you know, I do think this is incredibly important. Anytime you're talking about perceptions, trust, polling data, which is we do live in a unique age where trust is under assault in ways that we have never seen. I mean, if you look at every barometer out there, at every virtually every institution in society, the press, business, religion, elected officials, you go across the spectrum, they're all held at the lowest levels of trust since people began recording such information. And you have a system in terms of how people communicate that basically creates an entirely enormous negative feedback loop. Skeptical people reporting to cynical folks then echoing back to skeptical folks. And so I do think that when we talk about all of this stuff, particularly the trust issue, it's really important to understand that everyone is incredibly low now, and it's at some level a function and a reflection of the type of world that we live in.
Well, we'll leave it there, and we will continue, obviously, to watch the numbers. Thank you, Chris Lehane. He is Democratic consultant and partner with Fabiani and Lehane. And thank you, Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. And thanks to Charles Krauthammer, who was with us right up to the quarter of the hour, Pulitzer Prize-winning syndicated columnist and contributing editor to the Weekly Standard. And thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer today is Jim Bennett. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our interns are Keelan Cronin, Nick Zabrowski, Victor Valle, Angela Johnston, and Aaron Newport. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.